think I could do it.
It's up to you. Horizontal.
You might need it.
Without the mic.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's not the back as a hard
small thing. All right. I'll project. All right. Good morning, everybody. First of all, thank you very much for having me here at Michalalet. Just being in this room is absolutely remarkable. And sort of to frame what I would like to talk about today, and I think largely what you guys are going to be hearing about over the course of really the entire day, I think the first thing that everybody in this room should recognize is just what an unusual and atypical experience you've really given yourselves this summer. You have decided to come and basically spend the entire summer dedicated to your own personal growth, your own personal development, spirituality, learning, Torah, etc., etc. Suffice it to say that that's not something that the typical American young woman would likely be doing with their time. Suffice it to say that it's not something that the typical Jewish young woman would likely be doing with their time, and even the typical from young woman would be doing with their time. This is really a very, very special group, and it's very exciting just to be part of it and just to be able to be here and really stand in the room with all of you. And having said that, and along the lines of being a little bit different and doing things a little bit differently and being willing to consider your own personal experience and life experience in something of a different mode than what everybody else around you might be doing, I think really helps to frame what all of today's conversations are going to be about. And before I really get going here, just a brief word. There's something of this, I guess, unspoken assumption, presumption even, that whenever there is a shiur, a class, a lecture, what have you, it is assumed that the person at the front of the room is sharing their wisdom and sharing their advice because it's something that they've already mastered, it's something that they've already gotten, and it's already perfect. And I just want to begin by saying that the approach to technology and how we go about using technology and how we go about living in this world, on the one hand, as people who are concerned about their own spirituality, their own spiritual safety, their own emotional and mental well-being, their relationships, etc., is not something that I've the least bit mastered. It's something that I'm very much, I'm right there, I'm in the foxhole with you, and it's something that I think that we're all really trying to figure out as we go, and as this entire digital age and high-tech age continues to unfold, something that we're all trying to figure out together. So first and foremost, I just want to be very, very clear. This is a phone. This is my phone. It's an old model, but this is a smartphone. This is an iPhone. It's mine. It's mine. I use this. I use this regularly. So I just want to be very clear that come what may, whatever it is that we discuss and whatever conversation we have, and really over the course of the day, understand that this is something that is very much part of my life. And the goal here, I don't believe, is to say, therefore, throw it all away and be so iconoclastic and so against the grain and so anti-culture of popular society that we say that forget and let's just close the door. That's really not how we live. That's really an unhealthy way to live. And it's more a matter of trying to figure out balance. So with that in mind, let me just share the following vignette. And for whatever reason, this particular one stands out in my mind, personal story, although I'm sure that my life, especially over the course of the last number of years, is really full of these kinds of little anecdotes. Once happened that I was sitting in my kitchen and I was working on my laptop. Whatever it is that I was doing, maybe I was writing a drasha for Shabbos, I don't even know, checking email, whatever it was. And simultaneously, I was sitting in the room with my wife. My wife was on one side of the kitchen, I was on the other side of the kitchen. We're having a conversation. And she's talking to me, and I'm responding. I'm responding the way any good husband should respond, which is basically, And I happen to be, I think, the worst multitasker in the world, so it was that much more prominent and clear that I really wasn't especially paying attention. And finally, and I just thought that her language here was so worthwhile and made such a roshem on me, was not pay attention and not try to focus and not stop doing what you're doing, but she said, look at me. Look at me. Because if you're not looking at me, then you're distracted. And this idea of trying to simultaneously do two things at once and have two conversations at once. How have I two conversations? If only it was just two conversations. Three or four or five or six simultaneous conversations, it just doesn't work. And I think that that's something that we really need to keep in mind when we consider what it means to engage in an era, whether we like it or not, it's here. We're in an era in which it is totally commonplace. Long gone are the days when you would just have one conversation at a time. Long gone are the days when being distracted while you're having the conversation means you're talking to one person here and then another person, like in real life, in 3D, taps you on the shoulder and wants to have a conversation. Now it is literally 6 and 7 and 8 conversations all at the same time on multiple different platforms, multiple different streams, multiple different channels, multiple different apps, wavelengths, etc. And I want to explain to you why this is such a problem and why we don't really think of it, I think, as such a problem. So let's start there. So I'm very enamored with, just a show of hands, any 7 Habits of Highly Effective People fans in the audience. Yes, wow, it's still a classic. Awesome. Great. Amazing. Good for you guys. Please lend out your copies to everybody else in the room. I am a great fan of all of that self-help, productivity, that whole genre of goal setting and how to make the most of your time and how to be reflective and think about your time and your goals and your aspirations, objectives. Huge fan. So it was really Stephen Covey. No, Oliver Shalom, I guess. Stephen Covey, who first got me going on that particular path. But lots and lots of really great, amazing, amazing literature out there, all in that particular genre. Now, here's the issue. The issue is that that really touches on a very, I'll say, Jewish wavelength. Because as Jews, we recognize the importance of making every moment count, every minute count. Right? We understand that there's so many different things that we have to do in order to succeed and achieve as Jews. We are high achievers. Look around. Look around. It's how our societies are built. From society more so than any other. Because we need to achieve in our professional lives. We need to achieve in our family settings. We tend to have large families. So that means so many more people. We're connected to our extended families. And then there's like the whole Torah and Judaism and Avodas Hashem component. How is it that we go about serving Hashem? And we know that that is just the most multi-dimensional experience you could possibly imagine, more so than any other religion. So that we're taught, and especially now, here you are, you're spending your time in a whole environment of learning and learning and learning and learning. And the idea is make every moment count. And if I have a couple of minutes in between meals, then that's a time that I can sit down and I can do another shiur and I can have another seder and I can learn with another chavrusa and I can do another thing and I can have another experience and I can make a phone call and do chesed. And that's how we live. So what I want to point out is that there is a totally other stream all within Judaism that we don't give enough thought, and it is more critical today than it ever, ever was in history. Because it's so true that we try to be productive and we're doers and more and more and more and more. There's always another opportunity for chesed. There's always another friend you can keep up with. There's always another family member that you can reach out to. There's always another organization to be involved with. There's always another tzedakah. There's always another sefer. There's always another chavrusa. There's always another program. There's always another project. Always. But there's also an idea of stop. There is an inyan, there's a concept of slowing down, of giving ourselves, and I'm borrowing this term from that whole genre of sort of self-help and productivity and all that, there's an idea of maintaining margin. Margin. What does margin mean? So if you hold up this paper, we actually had a lot of back and forth because this source here right in the middle wasn't so legible. And I don't know that it's any better, but we'll try to get through it. But it wasn't so legible. Why? Because all of the ink just started to, like, smudge together. And it was very difficult to actually see. Letters weren't clear. By and large, for the most part, you pick up this paper and you can see what's going on. And this looks pretty much probably like every other source sheet you've seen and every other printed piece of paper that you've ever seen, more or less. Why? Because of this. That, and that, and that, and that. There is basically a square, or a rectangle rather, that runs around the perimeter of the page, which in the fancy publishing world is called a margin. Why does a margin exist? Why is it there? Right? In a multi-billion dollar a year industry, why didn't anybody ever have the realization that you could economize on the amount of paper that you had to buy and had to turn into a book and then had to incorporate into your bottom line of what you're spending money on? Why didn't anybody realize that, you know, every book could really just be half the size if you started all the way at the top of the paper and then ran all the way over to the other end of the paper, and then you did so on the next line, on the next line, on the next line, on the next line, so that the entire page was just completely filled up with ink? Now, I know this is obvious, but what would happen? Not a rhetorical question. What would happen? I know this is obvious, but just for the sake of a little back and forth here, what would happen if that was a game? Anybody ever think about that? Why doesn't that exist? Why doesn't that happen? Why don't we do that? Thoughts? It's too much to read. Thank you. Mariah. It's too much to read. It's too much to process. We just can't. We would be so overwhelmed. It would be so impossible. You just get hit with so much activity. There's so much going on. That how can the human eyes and how can the human brain and how can the human mind process the information that's on the page that I'm supposed to be understanding? So it makes a lot of good sense, but I want to show you that this is not just something that makes a lot of good sense and we can figure out on our own, but that this is very much a concept that is rooted in the Torah and in actual classical sources. Let's take a look at this is a classic Rashi. Classic Rashi, the very, very, very beginning of Sefer Vayikra, the very beginning of Parshas Vayikra. Vayikra, HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Rashi sort of goes off on something of a tangent, discussing what exactly Nevuah looked like, and what was part and parcel of Nevuah, the prophecy to Moshe Rabbeinu. So what is that? Let's take a look at the top source. Umahayu hafsakos mishamishos. Rashi asks, what's going on? What's the story with the breaks? What's the story with the pauses? Inside of a Sefer Torah, so you can find this in some Chumashim, some yes, some no, that you'll find that there are actual, like the Stone Chumash is great at this. There's an actual break in the text. There's an actual pause. Sometimes in the middle of a line, and sometimes it'll just be like a new paragraph. Like the line in a Sefer Torah will end in the middle, and then the next word won't pick up until the very next line. Sometimes there's a gap of a few letters, and sometimes it doesn't pick up until the very next line. Rashi asks, what's with the margin? What's with the extra space? Why is it there? Listen to this. L'tein revach l'moshe l'hisponein ben parsha l'parsha. To give a space, a revach, to Moshe Rabbeinu, to be misponein, to consider, to contemplate, to meditate, to reflect on what he'd just learned, what he'd just been told, ben parsha l'parsha, between each and every topic, ben inyan l'inyan, each and every subject. Kal v'chomer, all the more so, l'hedyo, to a regular person. Halomed min ha'edyot, who is learning from a regular person. When we flesh and blood, when we learn, when we study, when we process information, how critical it is that we take a break. How critical it is that we pause. How critical it is that we don't just fill in every space, because what happens is the pages of our lives become completely overrun with ink. And we can't process, and we can't think, and we can't consider. And how terrible that is. And the reality is that as much as I'm going to show it again, God remains. But if we reflect a little bit, I think we recognize that this is, more than anything, what is going to fill up the entire page with ink. That's a big problem. Because since we're Jews, and since we're from Jews, and then since we think about productivity and doing and doing and doing, there's always more to do. There's always something else that I can accomplish. I want to make use of these 30 seconds. I want to make use of these 10 seconds. I want to make use of these 5 seconds. What can I do? I can reach out to a friend. I can send a response. I can answer that email, Snapchat, WhatsApp. I'm already in my 30s. I'm very, very old. We have this thing called Facebook. I know nobody in this room is probably even familiar with that at this point. But that's what old people use in order to stay in touch with each other. There's always more to do. There's always another conversation. There's always another ridiculous, idiotic meme that I can send to my friends for a laugh. There's always something else. So we fill in and we fill in and we fill in and we fill in till the next thing you know, wow, that page is so full of ink that I don't think I processed any of this. Another example. Gemara in Shkalim. This is actually Yerushalmi. If anybody asks you if you learned any Gemara Yerushalmi this summer, you can tell them yes. Rabbi Pinchas b'shem Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish says as follows: HaTorah shenasan laHakadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe, the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Moshe, that Hashem gave to Moshe at Har Sinai, nitna lo, how was it given? Eish livana, white fire, charusa be'eish shechor, that was engraved with black fire. Isn't that a wild image? Think about the Torah as actually being fire itself. Yeish muvaleles be'eish, it was fire that was bound up in fire, mixed up with fire. Chatsuva me'eish, it was hewn from fire. Musuna me'eish, and it was given from fire. Dichsiv mimino eish das lama, from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's right hand, fiery religion. Religion of fire, Torah of fire, law of fire. I find it so interesting that we don't just think about the actual words of the Torah as being eish. We get it. It's fire, it's passion, it's exciting, it's enthusiasm. It's what gives content and meaning to our relationship with Hashem, and really content and meaning to our relationships with one another and ourselves even. But the white is fire also. That margin, that empty space, is a beautiful thing. It's a critical thing. It's important. Without the white fire, the black fire has no meaning. Without those spaces that we're giving to Moshe Rabbeinu, without the time in between, we just chill, we just reflect, and we just relax, and we have the opportunity to process, to take a walk, to not fill in every minute, to just think, to stop and to think, is something that's not only critical and important, but I believe what Rabbi Pinchas is saying is actually part and parcel of the Torah itself. You cannot separate between the black fire and the white fire. The content and the message, the communication, the law that is the Torah, is no more important than the spaces between that allow us to reflect, to wonder and consider how it's actually supposed to impact our lives. Quick idea, guys, that maybe you know, maybe you don't know, but that when we speak about Gemara and Sotah, let's read it together and we'll give a little background to this. Sach bein tefillah letefillah. When a man is putting on tefillin, arm tefillin, head tefillin, cannot pause in between, cannot break in between, no conversation whatsoever. So much so, that somebody who speaks between these two tefillin, we say, avera hi biyado, it's a transgression, it's an avera, a violation of halacha, v'chozer aleha me'orchei hamilchama, he goes back from war. There are a whole number of exemptions that are listed for who doesn't actually go out to battle, one of which is that a person who feels that there's a significant avera in his hand, and maybe he's not going to merit Hashem's protection out on the battlefield. It could be detrimental to him, it could be detrimental to other people, both if the protection is not actually there, and also just he's concerned that we don't need fear spreading through the camp like wildfire, especially on the front lines. What's that type of avera that we're talking about? So it's sach bein tefillah letefillah, somebody who speaks between the hand tefillah and the arm tefillah and the head tefillah. What's so egregious? What's so terrible? What's the story? Why that of all things? What's that meant to be representative of? What's that symbolic of? So many, many discuss the symbolism in general of tefillin, arm tefillin, head tefillin. What do you think? Any thoughts? What would the arm tefillin represent if we're speaking about sort of taking the parashios of Hashem and embedding them, right? A relationship with Hashem, embedding it on our arm, on our heads. Thoughts? Ideas? What do you think? Stab in the dark. Go for it. Arms and heads. What's important about... Yeah. One more time. Awesome. Oh, I love how you said that. We think about it and then we do it. Beautiful. Right? Arm is our maxim. Arm is our deeds. It's what we do. It's what we're engaged in. It's our physical activity, what we're engaged in over the course of the day. And also, our heads. How we think about it. Our thoughts, maybe our emotions. What we think, our perspectives. And I love how... What's your name?
Aliza.
Aliza, I love how you said it, Aliza. You said that we think about it and then we do it, right? We have to give forethought, which is so true, which is so true. You can't just go about doing and doing and doing. What I find so interesting is that actually when we think about the tefillin, it's in reverse, isn't it? It's not that first I put on my head tefillin so that I have to think about what I'm doing before I actually do it. It's true. So if ma'aseh b'machshavat techila, when we do a ma'aseh, when we do an activity, it has to be b'machshavat techila. It has to first be in our machshav, in our minds, in our heads. We have to give forethought. It's true. Think before you act. But what the tefillin seems to be suggesting is something else. that even after you do, once you do, once you've done, once you've engaged, you have to pause afterwards. You have to think about it. I just learned. I just had a shear. I just opened up a Sefer. And I gobbled up a whole couple of paragraphs. Did I give myself an opportunity to stop and think, how does that impact me? What does this mean? I did it. I did a chesed, next. I had a phone call, next. Conversation with a friend, next. I was a shoulder to cry on, next. Move on. Let me immediately fill in all that space. Another Snapchat, another WhatsApp, another conversation, another phone call, another this, another that, and do, and do, and do, and do, and do. The suggestion is that we have to stop. We've got to be able to pause. We've got to be able to pause. And as much as this is an incredible tool, appreciate the time that we're living in, the amount of chesed that you could do with one of these, the amount of interaction that we can have with one of these, the amount of comfort, the amount of time saving, theoretically, that these offer, it's all true. But this also is what fills in all that ink. It takes all that margin, it takes all of that white space, all of that clean space, and fills it in, and fills it in, and fills it in, and fills it in. And the suggestion here again and again and again is that we have to learn how to pause. We have to say that there are going to be those white spaces in my life that I refuse to allow entry to anything that's just going to completely overrun it with more ink. I want to think about this conversation that I had. I want to think about this time that I want to think about this experience. I want to think about this deal. I just went to see Eretz Yisrael. I was walking through the Holy Land. Every Dalet Amos, another mitzvah, another mitzvah, another mitzvah, every few steps that I take. It's beautiful. It's Hashem's land. Have I filled the whole thing in with selfies and posts and another, let me show all my friends where I am, let me show my family where I am, again and again and again, said I'm not even here anymore. I didn't give myself that white space around that ink, around that story, around that narrative, to stop, to pause, to think, to consider, what did this mean to me? What did it mean to me to be in Eretz Yisrael on this trip, to be out there, to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's land? What did it mean to have this conversation? What did it mean to have this, to hear this shir? What did it mean to learn this sefer? Did I stop? Did I pause? We have to be able to reflect. So guys, I want to share with you at least one instance that I believe the Torah says that this is how you put it in practice. And we're going to have to retrofit this a little bit. We're going to have to figure out how exactly this makes sense in our lives. How to sort of take this concept, this model that the Torah gives, and figure out how to make it relevant. But I want to share the following with you. First and foremost, we know about a Nazir. Yes? Anyone know about a Nazir? Very quickly, three prohibitions of a Nazir. Anyone got it?
Everyone needs to hair and wine.
Hair, wine, and touching a dead body. Contact with a dead body. All three. A Nazir is somebody who takes upon themselves, himself, herself. We always think about a Nazir as a man. The Torah is explicit that a woman could be a Nazir. A Nazir is somebody who takes upon themselves, not because the Torah says you have to, but it's a type of neder. I impose it upon myself, a verbal declaration, I hereby, I'm not going to say it, I hereby become a, and then the person becomes a Nazir. A Nazir means you refrain from cutting your hair, you refrain from drinking wine, and you refrain from coming in contact with a dead body. Three prohibitions. And I have them listed for you here. It's in Bamidbar, Parshas Nasa. Anybody know where we find this? Anybody know what the previous mitzvah was in Parshas Nasa? Eshet Sotah. Awesome. Eshet Sotah. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. So this is a very strange series of obligations, no? I would wager that if, you know, anybody was given the following exercise, come up with a list of three different prohibitions you could tack on yourself that would create additional holiness, that would make you come closer to Hashem,
that would make you more in touch with your personal spirituality and holiness somehow or another, we would probably not come up with these three.
Maybe some, not necessarily others. It's hard to make them all fit exactly. It's kind of like a Kohen. What does a Nazir have in common with a Kohen? Which ones? Touching dead body and wine. Right? Kohanim can drink wine, but not when they're about to perform the Avodah. See Nadav and Avihu for more information. Right? Many Mefarshim explained that the issue was that they drank wine, then offered whatever it was that they offered, and then were unfortunately taken by Hashem and Karbanos. They died after having performed that Avodah, bringing that Esh Zara. So, the last one doesn't exactly fit. What's with the hair? And that's sort of a sticking point for many Mefarshim. Everyone tries to figure out what's up with the Nazir, why these three specifically. I'm going to throw my hat into the ring. So I came across this explanation from Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch this past year. And I think it's so beautiful and so telling. If you can't exactly read along with me, I'm sorry that it's smudged. Not enough margin. What can we do? We're going to try to correct that in our own lives. Let's take a look together. He says that we have already said, by the way, just a quick point. Because I always feel the need to point this out. Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, his original commentary on Chumash was written in what language? Anybody know? German. So, the next time somebody, you know, is looking over your shoulder, looking askance, ugh, you're reading Rav Hirsch in, you know, in English, that's like not so serious. You know, you guys can like really be in seminary and everything's supposed to be done in Hebrew, and you know, it's kind of like flexing my textual muscles. Is that better? Okay. Flexing my textual muscles that I get to read everything in Hebrew. Just be aware of the fact, right, that the English of Rav Hirsch's commentary is actually a translation directly from the German. I believe the Hebrew is a translation from the English. And also, English and German are just more similar languages in the first place. So there's a certain sense and a certain feel of the original that you get when you actually read it in the English. Unless anybody here speak fluent German? No. Read fluent German? No. Okay. So stick to the English. That's my advice. Let's take a look. We have already said that hair serves to insulate. Rav Hirsch is asking, what's the story with the hair? It's so odd. By the way, how long does Naziris last for typically when you become a Nazir? Last for how long? For 30 days. 30 days. It's like going a little longer than usual without a haircut. So what's the story? What does this mean? They don't exactly walk around looking like a total hermit. What's the idea? Hair serves to insulate. Ever think about that? Hair serves to insulate. To reduce receptiveness to external influences, hence admission into or dwelling oneself to, or devoting oneself, I'm sorry, to the community, while giving up the aspiration to live only for oneself, is symbolized by Tiglachas Metzora and Tiglachas Levim. Levim will say for another time. Metzora will say for another time. But basically what Rav Hirsch is expressing or suggesting is as follows. Hair, and it's more difficult to think about it for ourselves, although it is true. I don't know if anybody's ever had a parent yell at them for going outside in the cold. Even if you're wearing a coat, you have to wear a hat. Why do you have to wear a hat? Because all of your body heat escapes through your head, or most of your body heat escapes through your head. So if you wear a hat, it keeps everything in. It's what hair does. Hair actually insulates. Hair is very, it's great. Like aside from, you know, styling and looking good and all of that, it actually serves a utilitarian purpose. It's functional. But think about animals, right? Animals regulate heat. With more hair, with less hair, they grow it long, they shed, etc., etc. Rav Hirsch's point is that symbolically, hair is an insulator. Hair says that I am disconnected from my environment. I'm disconnected from the atmosphere. I'm disconnected with what's going on around. It doesn't matter what the climate is out there, because hair insulates me. So that when the Nazir makes a point of growing his hair long, what he's effectively saying is, I'm detaching. I'm removing myself from everything that's going on out there. I'm not really part so much of society anymore. I'm taking a break. I'm kind of going on vacation from the rest of society. It's a fascinating idea. And I just want to extend that and to continue that same thought process to the other two prohibitions of a Nazir. We know, Chazal tell us, Ein Simcha Ela B'Yayin. What's wine? Wine is the quintessence of simcha, of joy, of happiness. When we get together, when we socialize, when we are one as a community, when we're one as families, around the Shabbos table, around the Yom Tov table, simchas, chasanas, wedding, bris, bar mitzvah, shabbat brachos, whatever, cup of wine. Dinner dates, cocktail parties, wine. Wine is the embodiment of a social drink, of social activity, of social engagement. Nazir says, I'm not going to drink wine for 30 days. Why? Because I'm going on vacation. I got to be by myself for a while. I got to detach. I need to get more in touch with not what's going on out there, but more with what's going on in here, and more with what's going on between me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There are lots of examples of chesed that we can think about. What's the ideal example of chesed? Anybody know? Chesed shalemes, thank you. What's chesed shalemes?
Like a dead body.
Dead body, dealing with a dead body. By saying that I'm not going to engage with a dead body, I'm not just saying that I'm not going to interact with tum'ah, I'm not just going to not interact with impurity, I'm detaching from the peak, pinnacle, paradigmatic example of chesed. Now them's fighting words. The Nazir is saying, no chesed for a month. I'm going on vacation. I'm going on hiatus. Not that I never want to serve the community again. Not that I want to be a hermit for the rest of my life. Not that I never want to interact with my community and my family and anybody else. But for 30 days, it's got to be about me. Not totally selfishly, but if I'm not for me, nobody's going to be for me. And then afterwards, I'll recognize that if I'm only for myself, I'm not really, what am I? I'm a nothing. So I'll go back. I'll go back at some point. But I need a period of time where it's not about chesed. It's not about interact. I'll tell you something. Does anybody, is it on the schedule here? Do you guys see the Pilichowskis at all? No? Anybody know the Pilichowskis here? Yeah? Irina Lisa Pilichowski? Oh, wow. If you see them, please send them my regards. Very, very, very special people. Very special people. So I know Rabbi Uri Pilichowski back from my days in Mevaseret. And at the very beginning of my Shana Aleph, so Rabbi Pilichowski mentioned something that really, it just hit me right between the eyes. It was so interesting. And he said, guys, you're in yeshiva for a year. You are going to have the rest of your lives to fill with opportunities for chesed. Hakhnasas orchem in your own homes, and in your communities, and getting involved in different organizations. It's beautiful. It's great. You're in yeshiva for a year. Let this be the year that you're actually in yeshiva. You do chesed for the rest of your life. This year, learn Torah. And by the way, they are among the biggest Baalei chesed that I know, that I've ever met. Certainly the greatest Machnisei Archim, I think, that I've ever met. We have to be able to detach. We have to be able to know that there are certain times that it's critical, that we're for ourselves. That we give ourselves that space, that we give ourselves that time to reflect, to consider, to think about ourselves, to think about who am I, what kind of person am I. And if I fill in every moment with another cocktail party, with another dinner party, with another opportunity for chesed, if I fill in every moment with being there for the community and for others and for friends and for friends and for friends and for friends, it's all good. We should be there for friends. We should be there for our communities. But we need to integrate that Esh Levana into the Esh Shechora. That white fire has got to be there as much as the black fire is. Because without those spaces to reflect and to consider, it's all lost. We're overrun. That black ink, that content, that meaning in life cannot be processed. Guys, I want to point something out to you. The word Nazir, it's an interesting word. Anybody think, like, linguistically, if there are, like, linguistic, you know, etymologic language kinds of nerds in the crowd, then great, great. We're happy to have you aboard on behalf of language nerds everywhere. happy to have you aboard. And if not, and you think this is the most boring thing in the world, this next little piece, then we'll be done in a second. But can anybody think for a second, consider, what the word nazir might be related to? Any other examples? And you could cheat a little bit on the... Yeah? What is a czar? A Russian... What?
A stranger.
A czar is a stranger. Awesome. Beautiful. Stranger with respect to what? Where do we often find it? Not always, but often. Excellent. It's come to the base of Mikdash. Meaning, you're a czar, you're a foreigner, compared to the Kohanim. Right? The Kohanim have sort of put themselves in a very, very special category, and everybody else has become a foreigner compared to them. Any other thoughts? Nazir related to? I wonder. That's like a Rav Hirsch idea. There's an extra letter there in the Shoresh, but I have to think about that one a little bit. Interesting. Nezer is a crown. Thank you. Amazing. Beautiful. Awesome. Guys, a couple of examples. Nezer is a crown. Fantastic. Let's take a look. I want to come back to Rashi in a little bit, but let's take a look at... let's go to Bamidbar Yud Zayin. Hey. Zikaron Livnei Yisrael Laman Asher Lo Yikrav Ish Zar Asher Lo Mizera Aaron Hu Lahaktir Ketores Livnei Hashem. This is in the aftermath of Korach. The context isn't exactly important, but I just want you to see exactly right that Zar is with respect to the Kahuna. You're a foreigner, you're an outsider, meaning there's something special. The Kohanim have sort of put themselves, or Hashem has put them in a special kind of place, a special kind of platform, on a pedestal. They're by themselves. Everybody else is a foreigner vis-a-vis the Kohanim. How beautifully that fits with Rav Hirsch's explanation of what a Nazir really is. A Nazir isn't just somebody who achieves greater Kedusha, part and parcel, like a Kohen. Part and parcel of achieving extra Kedusha means that other people have got to be foreigners. That other people, I can't just be here completely for everybody else. Relationship after relationship after relationship, conversation after conversation after conversation after conversation. There have got to be walls up to some degree where I say, I have to have my personal space. I have to have those times. I have to have those moments where I'm not going to be completely overrun by all of those other relationships. There's got to be that space that I create for myself. There's got to be that margin. There's got to be that white fire that gives context, that gives character, that gives meaning to the black fire. Another example of the other usage, exactly right, Nezer is a crown. La'aviv u'limo la'chivu la'chaso lo yitama. This is talking about a Kohen cannot become tamei to his... I'm sorry, the Kohen Gadol cannot become tamei to even his immediate family. Because the crown of God is upon his head. What is the connection between a crown and a foreigner? When I wear a crown, it says that I'm sort of in a place on my own. And that's exactly what a Nazir is really doing. A Nazir is saying that I'm in a different category. I cannot just be caught at the complete beck and call of everybody else, everybody vying for my attention. There needs to be a point at which I put up those walls and I say that, not now. I gotta have my space. I gotta have time to think. Gotta have time to reflect. I have to stop looking at my inbox and filling every 30 seconds and every 15 seconds, every 5 seconds between sentences and think that I'm still having a conversation with my wife. It's just that, as soon as she gets to the period at the end of her sentence, now I have 5 seconds to answer an email, and then I'll go back to the next sentence, and then I'll have another 5 seconds to answer a text, and then I'll go back, 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 and then I'll go back. It's important so that we can be people ourselves, we can think about what's important, so that we can connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, obviously like the Kohen, like the Nezer. But what I want to really underline, what I want to really highlight, is the reality that unless we step away from people sometimes, we also find that we cannot connect to people in the first place. Something of a paradox, but follow me. We mentioned before, the Nazir comes immediately. The Nazir comes immediately after the Parsha of Sota. Sota, without all the blood and guts and gore, basically discusses a situation of infidelity. Adultery. Marriage is crumbling. So Rashi asks, why would you take that parsha and then stick Nazir right afterwards? I'll tell you why. Lamanismicha parshas Nazir the parsha Sota. Why is it the parsha of Nazir comes next to the parsha of Sota? Why are they juxtaposed? Lomar lecha to tell you. Shekol haroa Sota bilkilkula. Anybody who sees the Sota in her degradation, in her despair, who sees the scenario of what happened to her, what happened to their marriage, Yazir atzmo min hayayin. He needs to separate himself from wine. Shehu mevi li deneyof, because the wine is really what started this whole adulterous relationship in the first place, that whole affair. So certainly wine, you get lightheaded and licentious and all of that, it's a problem. But I want to underline something I think even more significant, and perhaps what really Chazal are driving at, and Rashi is driving at. That when we're connected in the socialization, moving from one party to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, when we're in that mode, when we're on that wavelength, we might think that we're involved in relationship after relationship after relationship after relationship, but the reality is that we're not engaged in any relationship. We're seeing people, we're talking to people, but there's no depth. There's no content. There are no roots. There's no meaning. What happens with the Sota is that she and the man get caught up in a totally superficial relationship. It's not marriage. It's not an emotional connection. It's not a deep bond. They're not building a home together. They're not building a life together. Perhaps the Nazir sees that. This person sees that, gets scared out of his wits. Whoa. I knew that I had to step back in order to have a better relationship with myself, in order to have a better relationship with Hashem. But maybe I need to step back in order to have a better relationship with each other also. My bin adam l'chaveru, my ability to relate to those around me, my family members. If I have 1,000 friends, do I have any? If I've had 100 conversations today, have I had a single one? What is a relationship? What is a friend? What's a conversation? If I just keep moving from one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, is a single one significant? And guys, one final idea here. The Gemara in Bava Basra discusses, it's really two seemingly contradictory psukim that deal with the Kruvim. The Kruvim, the cherubs that stood on top of the Aron Kodesh. And on the one hand, one pasuk makes it sound like they face towards one another, and another pasuk makes it sound like they don't, like they face out towards the Mishkan. These two faces that stand on top of the holiest relic in all of Judaism, do these two faces face in or do they face out? Ulamanda Amr, second to last source, Pneyam Ish El Achiv. If you say that they're facing each other, Haksiv, but another pasuk says, Pneyam Labayas, that their faces turned out towards the house, towards the Beis HaMikdash. How could it be? Lo Kasha, no contradiction. Kan Bizman Shisrael Osin Ritzon Shel Makom. Here is where Klai Yisrael is performing Ritzon Shel Makom. The will of Hashem, the will of the omnipresent. Kan Bizman Shein Yisrael Osin Ritzon Shel Makom. Here is where they're not engaged with Hashem. When they're not involved deeply in that relationship with Hashem. How interesting that when we think about a relationship with Hashem, what we're not talking about is that, yeah, like I davened today, like, you know, I was davening Shacharis and Baruch Shem and not that, like, I was out and I was in Hashem's land and I was enjoying and I was just seeing and appreciating the beauty, and then also I was, oh, that's cool. Yeah, mountain. That's great. Yeah, it's in the stream. Streams are good. We love your date palm trees. Woo, palm trees. Yeah. And not that while I'm in the middle of having a conversation, I'm also answering and I'm also responding and I'm also posting. We've got to create those times where we disconnect, where we detach. Because the way that Hashem defines our relationship with Him is, look at me. Look at me. Our faces face towards each other when Osin Ritzono Shel Makom, when we're doing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. A relationship means focus. A relationship means commitment. A relationship means dedication. Relationship doesn't mean 15 conversations at once. Relationship means I had a conversation, and now I'm going to pause. I'm going to pause, and I'm going to think about what that conversation was just like. And guys, it's so interesting that that word zar, zer, nazer, comes up one more time. With regards to the Aron Kodesh, that area that encompassed those two kruvim that looked at one another, v'tzipiso, so zahav tahor, you cover the entire Aron Kodesh with gold, mibayis and michutz, inside, outside, tetzapenu, shall you cover it, v'asisa alav, zer, zahav saviv. And you place a crown. You place a separation all around the perimeter of the Aron Kodesh. Where is it that you have this symbolism of the two faces that look at one another, a Kadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael, that they're focused, that they're looking at one another? Only when there's a fence that's built around it. Only when there's this zer, only when there is this crown, only when there is a barrier that's been built around it. A relationship means that we're looking at each other right now, and everything else, come what may, however many buzzes I feel in my pocket, everything else for right now is on the outside looking in. Guys, I don't have the answers. I don't have the answers as to exactly how to integrate this and how to make this flow, how to make this a working model. It's something that I'm working on myself. It's something that I'm striving to achieve more and more of every single day. But put a couple of ideas in your minds. And this is at least what I try to work on personally, and hopefully it continues to expand into overflow. Those moments when we are absolutely engaging with another, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tefillah specifically, don't let the portal for every other quote-unquote relationship enter into my experience when I'm having a direct conversation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Come what may, it'll be over in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, 45 minutes, but demand that of yourselves. That if I am looking at Hashem, I'm creating that nazer around. I'm creating that border and I'm creating that barrier. Demand it of yourselves, expect it of yourselves, not during tefillah. Right afterwards, I'll be involved and I'll be engaged. One-on-one conversations. Meal times, you're in each other's company. You are surrounded in this incredible atmosphere, this incredible social circle, in person. Find the time to be in touch with everybody else. Fine, absolutely. Stay engaged. Know what the rest of your friends are up to. Know what the rest of your family members are up to. But when you're sitting down for a meal, for a conversation with another human being, not now. Panim el panim, face to face. Look at me. Chaver, it's a work in progress. It's a work in progress for all of us. You're going to have an entire day that's dedicated to figuring out exactly how, as frum Jews, as people who want to grow, people who are attuned to their own spirituality, who want to develop, want to continue on an upward, positive sort of trajectory, how it is that we deal with the age in which we live in. The age in which we live is a wonderful thing. It's a tremendous bracha. It's incredible. But it comes with its challenges. Don't turn a blind eye to those challenges. Recognize that they exist. Make demands of yourselves. Make certain expectations for how it is that, for your own sakes, for the sake of your relationships with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, for the sake of your relationships with your friends, your family members, present, future, how it is that you are going to demand and expect a little bit of margin in your life. How it is that you're going to demand and expect that black fire, that the Torah, the story of your lives is surrounded with enough context, with enough white space, with enough margin to be able to reflect, to be able to understand. For the sake of your relationships with each other, for the sake of your relationships with yourselves, for the sake of your relationships with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Guys, thanks very much for having me. Enjoy an incredible day.